RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Jeffrey Tucker is founder, author, and president at Brownstone Institute. He's also a senior economics columnist for Epoch Times, author of 10 books, including Life After Lockdown, and many thousands of articles in the scholarly and popular press. He speaks widely on topics of economics, technology, social philosophy, and culture. Just a quick bit again about the Brownstone Institute. The motive force of Brownstone was the global crisis created by policy responses to the COVID-19 pandemic of 2020. Now, that trauma revealed a fundamental misunderstanding alive in all countries around the world today, a willingness on the part of the public and officials to relinquish freedom and fundamental human rights in the name of managing a public health crisis. And Jeffrey Tucker is back with us on RCR for another chat. Thank you, Jeffrey, for coming back on again.
Sure. I'm always glad to hear those words because I framed them very carefully when I founded Brownstone. I wanted, because I knew they'd be read over the air and everybody'd be thinking about these words for years. And so I spent months crafting those sentences.
Okay. It speaks very clearly. Those words speak very clearly. I was very interested to read your piece, The Post-Ideological Age, in Brownstone a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And the first thing that occurred to me, left and right is dead, as we knew it, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I quite agree with this. In fact, just as I hopped on with you, I was on a phone call with a very conservative Catholic distributivist, a Chomskyite free speech advocate, an Emma Goldman style, left anarchist,
right?
Who's a literary scholar from Harvard, and we're all in the same team on an anti-censorship working group for Brownstone. So we're screaming at each other for an hour, but it's just glorious because the only thing that all of us have in common, really, apart from the desire to learn from each other, is a revulsion against the ruling class that conducted this color revolution in the West, by which I mean all Commonwealth countries, Europe and the U.S. and Latin America, against basic postulates of freedom. So it's not about left and right, like at all anymore, like at all. We don't even understand what those words mean. This is just about basic freedoms that we've been fighting for 1,000 years.
Yet we hear the term far right a hell of a lot now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So if left and right is dead, where does far right come
in? Yeah. This is a moniker they're placing on all dissidents. When I say they, I mean ruling class, incumbent elites. Anybody who disagrees with them, they've decided to label far right because that's the most discredited of all the groups out there for the last, 70 years, 80 years. And so we all become far right. I mean, it's funny for me because I'm called far right. And actually, like, I get called this all the time, but it doesn't quite injure me at all
because
I wrote one of the very few in print books, one of the very few that deconstructs right wing ideology from 1820 all the way up to 1946, in great detail. With deconstructing it and condemning it, it's called Right-Wing Collectivism, The Other Threat to Liberty. So I wrote this, it came out in 2017. I spent years in research. Rightist neo-Hegelian thought, I think, has been a cause of a great deal of woe in the world, from segregation in the U.S. to eugenics. You could read my book and see it. But I, of all people, have anti-right credentials. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I mean, you can buy that book on Amazon now, but it doesn't matter, right? Because I'm opposed to the existing COVID regime, I'm considered far right. It doesn't matter, my history, my writings, nothing matters.
What has been imposed upon us all is actually classically, if you want to think about 70, 80 years ago, far right. That's the thing.
I quite agree with that. Yeah, I quite agree with that. I was just reading F.A. Hayek this morning, his book, Road to Serfdom, 1944, which is an anti-Nazi treatise. Is a really important treatise, but he talked about the importance of censorship to the regime once they decide on a whole of society response to anything, whether it's industrial production or, you know, infectious disease control, you know, whatever it may be. They're going to necessarily impose propaganda and advertising to mold the public mind. And that is going to require censorship of dissidents who disagree, because those people are condemned as being dangerous to the rest of the social order. This was Hayek in 1944, talking about basically the Nazis. So, yeah. Yeah.
That's what's happening in the UK right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's happening all over the world. I mean, the censorship is very intense, and we just saw what happened in Brazil.
Yeah. What do you make of that, Jeffrey? Because that's a huge move, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, so we wouldn't even know about it except for Elon Musk. What happened is that the Brazilian government went after all social media, including Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram and you name it, and insisted they ban certain accounts. They all went along with it, and it was fine. Elon Musk said, no, I'm not going to do this. And so now they have to purge Elon Musk entirely from the public mind, because if he gets away with this, then they lose all control entirely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, it's been very heroic and very brave of Elon to do this. I have all the respect in the world for Elon. But my friends in Brazil are terrified about what's next, because they know they're on the list. They're not insurrectionists. They never denied the election of 2022, right? They never claimed that Bolsonaro really won. But they're on the list because they're regime dissidents. They're not willing to go along with everything. So Brazil is being used right now, my friend, as a kind of a sandbox for what they want to do in the UK and the US.
Yeah. And, you know, $9,000 fine per day for using a VPN, really?
Right. Well, they had to pull back from that slightly and said...
Oh, have they?
Yeah. Well, they said, okay, you're not going to be fined if you say irrelevant things, but if you attack the regime, you will be. So now that's also censorship, right? I mean, this is not an improvement.
No.
But it means you can't actually speak your mind. And so here in the West, and I consider Brazil part of the West, we are facing extreme censorship controls that Machiavelli and, quite frankly, Hitler would have been, and Stalin would have been all for. So it's happening to us right now. This is going on right now, right under our noses. Like, you cannot turn away, you know, and pretend like this is not happening. It is happening.
One thing that I've noticed, and I'm sure many other people have, being in media and being in news for a long time and kind of knowing the flow of news, is it seems that it's more than just propaganda. People actually believe that they're thinking things they've been told. You know, they're not just sort of going along with something. The persuasion is so strong that it's like they thought of it. And that is next level, isn't it? That's really next level.
Yeah, Hayek talks about this too. I urge everybody to go to his book, 1944 book called Road to Serfdom, and read that chapter on the end of truth. Because people come to believe the things that they comply with. I mean, that's so the way it goes. They eventually internalize the propaganda that they with which they comply, and so the elites are actually creating the very thing that they hope to create. And how does it happen? Well, it happens because of you know, people want to be fashionable. They don't want to be unfashionable. They don't want to say things that are contrary to the dominant narrative. They want to keep their jobs and so on. So it works, right? I mean, this is how it happened under communism, under Nazism, under probably medieval regimes that were advancing this religious theory or that religious theory. People tend to go along. And it's a problem because officially we operate under this idea of democracy, which is that, you know, the people should be in charge of the regime. But what happens if the regime flips the narrative and says, oh, no, actually, we're in charge of you, and you cannot vote us out, and we're going to use various techniques to make sure that you comply? And that's what's happening right now. Everybody's being propagandized. You're excluded from seeing information that is contrary to regime narratives. We're seeing this in Brazil right now, to some extent in Germany and in France and in Spain, to some extent in the UK, and to a lesser extent in the US. But it's coming here. It's coming everywhere.
How much of this is class warfare?
More than I wanted to think about, I would say, like 5 years ago. People of my ilk, and I'm basically a libertarian-oriented guy, always dismissed Karl Marx because his whole analytical framework was about class. If you're of this class, you think this way. If you're of this class, you think that way. And I never wanted to think that way. But with the lockdowns, what we saw was a ruling class that was very happy to work at home on their laptops and have groceries delivered by the working class, to whom they thrust in front of the virus and said, you get sick, not me, right? So it was entirely a form of class welfare. And then we saw the transfer of wealth by the multiple trillions, tens of trillions, from the working classes to the elites. And you can look at any chart. The 1% have gotten richer. The lowest 10% have gotten desperately poor. The lowest 50% desperately poor. So we're seeing a pillaging of the working class and the bourgeoisie on behalf of the ruling class and the upper class and the permanent bureaucrats and the financial elite. There's no question that that is what has happened over 5 years. So Karl Marx's view of class warfare turns out to be much more, I would say, have more explanatory power than I ever wanted to think about.
Yeah. Yeah,
right.
I hear you.
Which is why all my best friends are leftists now, because they understand this, right? And in fact, I was just talking about Emma Goldman on the phone calls with right before this conversation began. I called her Emma Goldman because she kind of seems like Emma Goldman to me. She was raging. She said, "This is class war," and this is an anti-censorship person, anti-lockdown, anti-vaccine mandate person. She's like, "This is a class war. We're going to engage this class war," and made me laugh because it made me think of Emma Goldman. But it is class war. Absolutely, that's what it is. It's the elites and the privileged versus the exploited, working classes especially, but middle classes too. Everybody.
There were quite a few institutions, I'm thinking of churches, civil liberties organizations, those kind of institutions that failed to resist government overreach. The one that surprised me the most is churches, actually. Yeah. And I know of many church-going people who were denied entry to their church and have left the church since then. They haven't had their faith in the Almighty dented, but they've disconnected from religion now.
Yeah.
Did that, anyone buying would surprise you, but that.
I can only tell you from the US point of view, because I watched it most closely. The mainline churches were completely compliant. Mainline conservative and reformed Judaism, mainline Catholicism, mainline Protestantism within Presbyterianism, the Episcopalians were kind of the worst. They all went along. So what groups did not go along within religious world? It was the ultra Orthodox Jews, the dissident Mormon groups, because the mainline Mormons went along, the dissident Catholic groups, and the independent evangelicals. So there was definitely a class structure within the religious groups themselves. And it's, I don't know, you know, I think it has something to do with success, right? The more successful you are within the structures of power, the more compliant you tend to be. But the more marginal you are, and the more the media ignores you, the more you believe in your principles. So all these religions, these marginal religions that truly believed in what they were saying, stayed open. But all the mainline religions that are very deep into the corporate class, they've been making nice with the media for decades now, you know, utterly and completely complied. I mean, the Vatican itself had vaccine mandates. I don't know if you know that, but you could not get into Vatican City without having had a vaccine. And the American bishops approved the abolition of Easter services in 2020. And blocked even Christmas celebrations later that year. And I don't know what you want to say about that, but if your religion and your religion is about the birth of God and the resurrection of God after his crucifixion, and you cancel services.
Mm. Even Jesus was canceled.
Jesus was canceled by the Catholic Church.
Incredible.
It's just true. It's incredible.
The concentration of power in government and corporations, is that a done thing? Is this game kind of over? Are they so entrenched with power now, that mix?
I'm afraid it was over long ago. But the good thing about our times is that now we see it. Whereas in the past, I think it seemed normal. Life was good. We were prosperous. We were not locked down. We were not injected with random, you know, untested substances and that sort of thing. But all that happened. And now we see what was probably always true, but we didn't have the reason to see it. It wasn't revealed to us. But then suddenly out of nowhere, the curtain flew open and we could see everything. And so now the corporatocracy and the captured agencies and the intermixing of all the financial interests with Wall Street and big tech and big pharma and agency control, it's all just in front of us now. And we're shocked. We're amazed. Like, we thought life was good. We're happy. And now we see it was all corrupt. And, you know, unfortunately, it didn't really affect us until they went for our families, our lives, our schools, and our communities and our businesses. So in a way, it was a kind of an overreach that they did in 2020 through 2022. And we're still traumatized by this. And the question is, like, I always ask, you know, if they're so brilliant, why did they do this? Like, why would you reveal the fullness of the hegemon?
That's a very good question.
You know, why would you reveal the fundamental compulsion behind the system so brazenly in ways that were so injurious to the masses? And I think the only reason that I can come up with was fear of the rising populist movement. In Brazil, in the UK, in Europe, and the US. So you had Boris Johnson, you had Donald Trump, you had Bolsonaro, you had the rise of independence movements in Spain and Germany and, you know, all over the planet. So you had the emergence of a new global elite that engaged in what George, I think it's George W. Bush, called shock and awe.
Yeah, shock and awe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in Iraq, the idea was like, okay, Saddam Hussein used to be our ally. He's not expecting us to bomb the hell out of all of his cities. And if we do this, then he's going to feel an existential threat and comply. So the U.S. engaged in shock and awe. So just move the troops in, slaughter people, bomb the cities, really shock you and make you overwhelmed with a sense of awe. And I think that's what happened in the COVID period in the West by our own governments.
It was that might ex-
yeah, sorry. Who's in charge? Who's in charge? We're in charge. That's the idea.
And we're gonna show you. Yeah. That would explain then the approach to Russia, because they're a nationalistic culture, aren't they? And they're not sort of playing the game, and they're an Orthodox religious country now. So that goes against everything you're just saying. And that might answer some of the what looks like a rational approach to Russia.
Yeah, I think that's right. So you have many dissident regimes around the world who don't care anything about this globalist crap, right? So you've got Liechtenstein, you've got Costa Rica, Nicaragua, you've got Hungary, you know, you've got Russia. So some are regimes about which we really care because they have nuclear weapons and that sort of thing. Mm. And others we don't care anything about, like Nicaragua and Costa Rica. Like, nobody cares, you know, because
they don't have nuclear weapons.
They don't have nuclear weapons. They don't even have militaries. So, okay. But the ones with, and Hungary is supposed to be part of NATO, right? So they're really pissed about Hungary going its own way. But yeah, these independent regimes that are doing their own thing. You know, I'm of a generation, I'm sorry to report to you, that was propagandized against Russia to such an extent that it's hard for me to release my old understanding of Russia. Like, I was raised, I mean, the reason why our money says, the reason our Pledge of Allegiance says one nation under God, and our money says in God we trust, is because we were fighting against atheistic communism, right, in Russia. And here it is now, 30 years after the end of the Cold War, 35 years after the end of the Cold War, and Russia is being denounced as a theocratic nation. Now, you know, maybe Russia went from atheism to extremist theocracy in the blink of an eye, and for reasons that were never explained to me or never asked, or maybe we were just lied to for decades and decades about the nature of the society. You know, it's pretty interesting to kind of consider. I think it's more likely we were just lied to all along during the Cold War about the nature of Russia. But I think you're right. This is a traditional society, very devoted to Russian Orthodoxy and religious principles and traditional morality and that sort of thing, which in the wake of the woke color revolution in the West puts it on the bad guy list, right?
Yeah.
Same thing with Hungary.
They're the ones who could really push back. They really could if they wanted to. Yeah.
About
the only ones.
Yeah.
Where we started this chat, this whole breakdown of left and right, so new kind of groups are forming, and it's a mix of a spectrum that used to be divided into categories before. Coming together, I'm thinking of the Canadian truckers and the and other groups. So how do you see this, you know, to use that well-worn term, playing out? Are we going to have alternative sort of clusters of ways of living, trying to detach from a system that doesn't seem it's going away anytime soon? Do we get defeated? Do we win at any point? How do you see it going?
Well, okay, so you asked a lot of questions. I mean, the first one is that left and right is no longer matters. Yep. There are good people on all sides. And to use Trump quote, the good people on all sides.
Charlotte.
And so we need to be open to hearing different perspectives, which is
We're coming together. So this is new forming groups.
Yeah.
How do we go about what we need to do?
Well, this is what Brownstone is. Mainly what my world is, unfortunately, like, you know, mostly intellectual and academic, right? So I'm pulling together all sorts of academics from every point of view, and we're shoving together. We're learning what we didn't know from each other. And it's so fascinating to me because everybody comes from a different tradition and we've read different writers. And we're introducing each other to our own traditions of thought. And it's been fascinating to me. And it's like whatever else is wrong in the world, it's been intellectually so exciting for me. You know, it's like been thrilling to assemble these new groups. And we're so intrigued by each other, really. Like one of my most closest intellectual collaborators right now is a PhD in neo-Marxist political economy, which I never, you know, PhD at Sydney, actually, which I never would have imagined. And we're so intrigued by each other. And not that we agree on everything. We don't. I mean, but we learn from each other, right? I mean, this is how we're doing now. And it's really exciting. But one of the things we're all together trying to figure out is a really basic question. If you're going to have fundamental social and political and economic upheaval to transfer from one unsatisfactory status quo to a new kind of emancipatory system under which we feel free again, how precisely does this happen in an industrialized Western democracy? So that is the question. And there's no aspect of history that informs us about that. Like, we just don't know. We think we know how revolutions occur in Eastern Europe under totalitarian systems. You know, we've seen regimes overthrown through conquest, through bombings, through populist movements to overthrow a demoralized ruling class that no longer believes in their own rhetoric, regimes depleted of resources so they can no longer resist pushes from. We've seen militaries flip from one set of loyalties to another. We've seen all this. What we've never seen is what revolutions look like in industrialized Western democracies that presumably existed under the rule of law, in which there's mass popular incredulity towards the ruling class. We don't know what that looks like. So
yeah,
we're living in that now. Right? So exciting times to be alive, because every single day, every hour, we're seeing new things unfold before our eyes. And we're astounded. We're amazed. And we're wondering who's going to win and what it's going to look like. That's where we are.
Let's leave it there, Jeffrey. Jeffrey Tucker, founder, author, and president of Brownstone Institute. Thanks for coming back on our radio station, Reality Check Radio. Another reality check there. And I look forward to reading your material and chatting again sometime. Thank you.
Thanks so much. All the best.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.